Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
As a plant-based cheese company, Daiya has never talked about beef in an ad before, because someone somewhere once had a beef with saying beef and plant-based together. So putting a slice of Daiya cheese on a beef burger, not okay. Well, our delicious melty cheese has a beef with your beef about beef, because any step towards plant-forward eating is a step in the right direction. Daiya, 100% plant-based, even if you're not. Now made with Daiya Oat Cream Blend.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week I'm very happy to say we have Matthias Diesermann on the show, and we'll be talking about his very interesting book, Historiography in Saudi Arabia, Globalization and the State in the Middle East. I confess to Matthias that I know absolutely nothing about Saudi history, and I'd be willing to bet that most people don't know a lot about it. So it's a particular blessing for us to have him on the show today. This is an incredibly important part of the world, and one that I think that most people don't really just are totally ignorant about, which is too bad, I would say. So first of all, I want to thank Matthias for writing the book. Thank you and appearing on the show.
My great pleasure.
Absolutely. Could you kick the interview off for us, Matthias, by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, with pleasure. My name is Matthias Diesermann. I'm teaching as a faculty member at Virginia Commonwealth University in Qatar, but I'm not a Qatari, not a Saudi, but I'm originally from Germany, and I'm currently spending parts of my summer in Vienna, Austria.
Mm-hmm. And explain to us then, how did you get into studying, Arabs? Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I studied history and Arabic studies for my first degrees at the University of Vienna in Austria. And I wanted to do history from my high school days. I'm one of those perhaps many historians who had a great high school teacher who inspired me to go on to do history. However, I wanted to do non-European history because I am from Europe and I just wanted to learn about another culture, another world region. And I graduated from high school in 2003. And that was, a time when, unfortunately, the Middle East was perhaps the hottest non-European world region, not just in terms of temperature, but also, obviously, in terms of politics. 2003 was the invasion of Iraq. 2001 was 9/11, obviously. 2002, the war in Afghanistan. The Middle East, the Arab world, was around 2003, very much in the media as it has been ever since. And so I think that just attracted me to the study of Arabic and the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask as a preface, I don't think it's very easy to study Arab history in the United States. I'm sure lots of people will tell me I'm wrong, but is the study of Arabs and sort of Middle Eastern culture and history well-developed in the Deutsche Sprachraum, in the German-speaking regions?
Yes, it is. The German-speaking Sprachraum, as you said, had a long tradition of Orientalist scholarship. The Habsburg Empire was, of course, bordering for a long time with the Ottoman Empire. The Habsburg had a long history of relations with the Ottoman Empire, and there were always, or for long periods, there have been schools teaching diplomats Arabic and Oriental languages in general.
Yeah, I'm a little bit aware of that. I mean, I only say that because I know a lot of historians, partially because I host New Books in History, but also because I've been in the discipline for about a quarter century, and I don't think I can name a single historian of the Arab Peninsula. I mean, I know hundreds of historians, but I can't name one. So it's kind of a remarkable thing you've done, and I'm sort of in awe of it. It's a very brave thing to do.
Thank you so much.
To do something like that. So why did you write Historiography in Saudi Arabia, Globalization and the State in the Middle East?
Like you, I didn't know many historians who worked on the Arabian Peninsula. So I feel that this was kind of a fresh field of study with, a lot that can still be done, a lot of history that can be written, recovered. However, perhaps a more personal reason is that I actually, after completing my undergraduate studies in Arabic and history, I got a job teaching German language at a Saudi university, King Saud University. And so I found myself in the country connecting with Saudi historians, talking to them, visiting their workshops. And then I decided to do a PhD on the history of Saudi Arabia. And basically, because there were so few Western historians of Saudi Arabia, I wanted to start by basically reading everything that Saudis have ever written about their history, or at least trying to do so. And so I've studied this topic, historiography in Saudi Arabia, for my PhD, and the book is basically a revised version of that PhD thesis. The PhD thesis was completed at the School of Oriental and African Studies, which is part of the University of London.
It's funny you mentioned that studying reasonably, I don't know how best to put it, but studying obscure topics of important nations. So I used to study, I guess I still do study to some extent, medieval and early modern Russia. And I had trouble explaining to people why anybody would ever be interested in that. And one of my professors explained it best. He said, you know what? It's probably not very important to you, but it's really important to them. I think that's pretty much right. So let me ask a further question before we get to the book. Saudi Arabia is not a liberal culture. It is an absolute monarchy. I don't know if you would call it an Islamic state, but Islam is very extraordinarily important in it. They have censorship laws. How do you go about studying Saudi history in that environment?
How do Saudi historians do?
How does one in general, and how did you?
It's true. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a conservative country. It is a monarchy whose government is not elected. Many would see, including many Saudis, would describe their country as an Islamic state. The Saudi government certainly would like to see it itself. And it is perhaps closest to, an Islamic state among countries today. However, as in any societies, obviously there are conservatives and there are liberals. Saudi Arabia has witnessed a kind of opening since the early 2000s. 2001 was not just a shock for America and the rest of the world, but also for Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden was, for most parts of his life, a Saudi citizen. Many of the hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. And also Saudi Arabia recognized in the early 2000s, if it had not done before, that it had a domestic terrorism problem as well. At the same time, of course, Saudi Arabia was getting a lot of bad press in other countries. In America, there was a lot of criticism. And at that time, the certain Saudi institutions perhaps reacted to that by inviting foreign scholars like myself to study the country and to learn about the country and learn it perhaps in a better way than many journalists did who wrote about Saudi Arabia, perhaps in a more superficial way. So I had great support actually from the Saudi side, especially from one center called the King Faisal Center for Research and Islamic Studies. It is connected to one part of the Saudi royal family, and they provided me with a visa. They provided me with, contacts with official letters. So thanks to them, to that King Faisal Center for Research and Islamic Studies, I actually had a very good time in Saudi Arabia, and it was a very good and comfortable and safe experience to do research there.
That's interesting. So they seem comfortable with that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's interesting.
I think so.
Yeah, that's very, it's very interesting because, you know, I mean, I did research in the Soviet Union and they were not comfortable with anything. I think that's largely because they realized sort of how tenuous their control was of the place that they governed. Whereas I imagine that the Saud family is much more secure.
I think so. I mean, it is one of the most stable, wealthiest, and safest places in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, not just in comparison with Syria and Iraq and Egypt, but also obviously with other oil states such as Libya, for instance. So, yeah, it is a safe and comfortable place. And like, I think the Saudis, they knew that after 9/11, they got in a lot of bad press. So I think an academic researcher who would write about Saudi Arabia would perhaps, yeah, help them, also help them solve their problems, and would certainly write something that is more nuanced and better than many accounts by journalists who only spend very brief periods of time in the kingdom, if at all.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, what they're saying is we really have nothing to hide. We'd invite you to come here and check us out. Yeah, that's very interesting. So let's actually talk about the meat of the book, and that is about the writing of history by Saudis of their own history. And when we talk about Saudi history, where exactly do we start? I mean, I know that the Saud family came to power in the 30s. Is that right?
Right, or at least in the 1930s, that was when the current modern state, modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia, was formally established under that name.
Mm-hmm.
The Saudi family is a native family of Arabia that has been in Arabia for hundreds of years and actually established two states before the current modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia. There was a first Saudi state from around the middle of the 18th century until the early 19th century, and there was a second Saudi state in the middle decades of the 19th century. So many historians actually trace back the history of modern Saudi Arabia to the middle of the 18th century when the first Saudi state was established. However, when, of course, history begins in Arabia, is in itself a contested issue.
Yeah. The reason I ask this is that, you know, in most dynastic states, and this was certainly true in early modern and medieval Europe, that history was the history of the monarchy, and it was dynastic history. And that is sort of where your book starts, with dynastic history. So could you talk a little bit about that?
So there has been a long tradition of dynastic historiography, history focusing on great men, history focusing on political events, on the rulers. And like you said, that is not that different in itself from dynastic history. It's written in many other countries in many different periods of history. So even or already during the first Saudi state, you had one important chronicler in particular called Hussein ibn Rannam, who wrote a foundational work on history, on the history of the Saudi state and on the history of the Wahhabi mission, that is the mission of a religious reformer called Shaykh, or sometimes Imam, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. And the Wahhabi mission, actually, that is associated with the Al Saud family or with the House of Saud, is actually what distinguishes Saudi dynastic histories from the dynastic histories of many other countries. Saudi dynastic histories for a very long period of time and to some extent still in the present, up to the present, have a strong religious element. Saudi dynastic histories have tried to legitimize the actions of Saudi rulers, the establishment of the Saudi state, religiously, often by describing the pre-Saudi condition as very bad politically and, importantly, religiously. And historians of the Saudi dynasty, like Ibn Rannam and his followers, Ibn La'abun, Ibn Bishr, and others, they especially used an Arabic and Islamic notion of the Jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah means an age of ignorance. It means the opposite of Islam. And basically, these dynastic historians constructed history as in a way that before and without Saudi rule, there was the opposite of Islam. There was a time of infighting, of abominations, of everything that is negative, almost.
So it was the Saud family and the they brought the Wahhabis with them, I guess, and that brought this new enlightenment. Is that maybe a word we could use?
Certainly, they brought light to Arabia, although a religious light, so the light of Islam, if you will.
So I was going to say, were these historians that you're talking about, were they in the employ of the Saud family?
Yes, they were. In one way or another, these historians, so I mentioned Ibn Rannam, Ibn La'abun, Ibn Bishr, were at some point on the payroll of the Saudi state and received support, also material support, such as paper, from the Saudi state.
And did they have any, I was going to say formal training, but had they attended university someplace, or were they just simply court historians?
Good question. Actually, the first Saudi University, King Saud University, where I myself taught, was only founded in 1957. For long periods in the 18th, 19th century, early 20th century, there were no universities at all. So the religious scholars among the historians, they had a traditional religious training in these central region of Arabia called Najd.
So they were essentially brought up into this tradition, and once the Saudi family sort of consolidated the state, they began to write dynastic histories, which were apologetic, we might call them. They explained why the Saud family was in the position it was in, explained and justified.
Exactly.
Yes. So this begins to change, you say, in the 70s, when I won't say change, that local histories begin to appear. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There There's also a very long tradition of local historiography in the Arabian Peninsula, especially in the holy places of Islam, Mecca or Mecca and Medina. So over hundreds of years, actually, histories of these places were written. However, in the course of the 20th century, as the modern Saudi state was established, the number of these local histories actually increased, and also we have increasing histories from an increasing number of regions. So not just the older centers of learning, Mecca and Medina, but also of oases such as Al-Ahsa in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, or in the southern region of Saudi Arabia called Asir. So there is some a proliferation of local histories in parallel to the to the production of dynastic histories.
I see. So then, I found this very interesting because it matches a kind of it's a moment at which Saudi history is in sync with other Arab histories, and that is the 60s and nationalization. And this broaches the topic of the development of the Saudi state itself, its enlargement, also the emergence of a Saudi nation, and nation is in quotes, and then, of course, globalization. Can you talk about the ways in which these three things shaped Saudi historiography in the 60s and the 70s?
Great question. Nationalism, the expansion of the state, and also globalization affected both dynastic historiography and the various local and regional historiographies throughout the kingdom. Globalization and state expansion are sometimes seen as contradictory. So globalization is sometimes seen as the antithesis of the nation state. However, in many cases, and especially in the Saudi case, there's actually a connection between the two. So the expansion of this modern Saudi state was made possible through the growth in oil revenues, which of course depend on the global market and the global consumption of fossil fuels, which expands with globalization. Also, nationalism becomes important as with globalization, as the Saudi state engages with other nations in a more intensive way. So in its dealings with other nations, you need symbols of a nation, like national anthem, like borders, like passports, like a flag. So we actually see this parallel expansion of the Saudi state, globalization, and growth of Saudi nationalism. Growth of Saudi nationalism affected both dynastic historiography and local and regional historiography. In terms of dynastic historiography, the religious legitimation becomes less important than it was before the 1950s. So now you have a national legitimation, and whereas in the past you had the notion of jahiliya, of age of ignorance, the opposite of Islam, that was in a background to the establishment of the Saudi rule. From the 1950s, 60s, 70s onwards, you had division, national division as becoming the prominent background to the establishment of the Saudi state. And the Saudi state was seen as the unifier of Arabia. So it was still seen as the state that brought Islam and the Wahhabi movement, the Wahhabi mission, but it was also seen as the state that unified the country. So similar to Bismarck, for instance, or in Germany, or Garibaldi in Italy, you had a Saudi unifier. And that became King Abdulaziz Al-Saud, the first Saudi king who ruled between 1902 and the early 1950s. So he was seen as the unifier. But of course, after the kingdom was unified in the 1930s, then you needed an additional legitimation for the subsequent Saudi kings. So King Abdulaziz was seen as the unifier, if you will, as the Bismarck of Saudi Arabia. And subsequent Saudi kings were seen as the developers of the Saudi kingdom. So you had economic development and social development and all other kinds of developments. And the subsequent Saudi kings who ruled between the 1950s and the present were seen as the developers of the country. So we see two national tropes, unification and development, becoming important in dynastic historiography. In local historiography, we can also see the influence of the rising nationalism. So previously, before the 1950s, there was little Saudi nationalism in the local histories. Local histories were very particularistic. They focused on a given town or region on its own terms. They didn't write much about the House of Saud. They didn't write much about the Wahhabi mission. They wrote more about local customs, local traditions, social traditions, also religious traditions, some of which were actually suppressed under Saudi rule, but then recovered by local historians. There was also the notion that people of Mecca and Medina were actually Muslims before the rise of the Wahhabi movement. So in that sense, local histories challenged that those earlier religious dynastic narratives that said that before the House of Saud, before the Wahhabi mission, the condition of the country was the opposite of Islam almost. Now, I said the local histories were also influenced by nationalism. So again, we see religion after the 1970s actually becoming a bit less important, not disappearing, but becoming less important, and national narratives are becoming important. And then the subsequent local and regional histories were contribution histories. So whereas the dynastic history is focused on Saudi kings as the main actors, the unifiers and developers of the country, different local historians try to argue for the contribution of their town or region to the unification and development of the country. So we see histories saying that this town or this tribe actually made an important contribution to the establishment of the nation and hence is a very valuable part of the nation and perhaps should receive a fair share in the wealth of the country. So this is sort of a subtle challenge then to the dynastic histories, whereas many dynastic histories would like to portray the country and the achievements of the country as exclusively the product of the actions by rulers. We have from the various towns and regions, local historians who want to claim their share in the history of the nation and by implication, perhaps also in the wealth of the nation through their own narratives.
That's very interesting. And there are lots of parallels to other nation builders, I would say, over the 19th and 20th century. One of them that I think is similar to all of these other nation building efforts, but is also different. And that is that the Saudis had to deal with the fact that although they were saying that the people of the Arab Peninsula were one, they were in fact many. That there were Bedouins and there were tribal divisions and things such as this. So that's one difficulty in claiming that there was a unified Saudi nation, if they claimed that. But the other difficulty, and the one that makes it unique, I don't know if it's unique, but the other makes it different, is pan-Arab nationalism. And the Saudis, as I remember, were very early, they were quite enthusiastic about this early on. And the 1960s was sort of the high point of it, the late 1960s. So how did they deal with these two complications of their national narrative? And I'm particularly interested in the pan-Arab nationalism one, because that one is really nothing, you know, it's hard to, it's like, it reminds me a little bit of pan-Slavism, you know, it's sort of try to unify all the Slavs, but go ahead and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Pan-Arabism or Arab nationalism is actually older, considerably older than Saudi nationalism. Mm-hmm. Arab nationalism, pan-Arabism perhaps goes back to the 19th century, and Saudi nationalism perhaps to the 1970s or perhaps 1950s, and most of the 1930s, really. So initially, many dynastic histories in the first half of the 20th century were actually pan-Arab or Arab nationalist rather than Saudi nationalist.
That's interesting.
That had to do with the fact that in the first half of the 20th century, many people who wrote dynastic histories were actually non-Saudis. They were Arabs often from Egypt or from Greater Syria, that is Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, who had an advantage in education over many Saudis and who were employed by the royal court because of their expertise and also because these foreigners actually didn't have a local power base. So the Saudi family could entrust powers to these foreigners in the royal court, knowing that these foreigners would not be able to take over. And these foreigners from Syria, Greater Syria, or Egypt, they were often Arab nationalists. And they looked at other Arab countries and tried to legitimize this Saudi state also in the eyes of fellow Arabs. That was especially important in sort of the 1950s, one of the high points of Arab nationalism. Subsequently, in the 1960s, the relationship between the Saudi monarchy and Arab nationalism was a bit more uneasy because Arab nationalism was championed by the president of the United Arab Republic, or Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, or Nasser, who was a Republican, a socialist, a strong basically monarchical figure. So in the 1960s, actually Saudi rulers and Saudi historians to some extent wanted to promote pan-Islamism rather than pan-Arabism. Nevertheless, many Saudis also have seen these different nationalisms not as contradictory to one another. I talked to one historian called Abdullah Al-Uthaymeen, prominent dynastic historian who actually describes his loyalties in terms of circles. So he is first a Saudi, and then he is an Arab, so a member of the wider region, and then he is a Muslim, a member of the largest community. Mm-hmm. Arab nationalism figures prominently, especially in the period between the 1920s and 1950s or 1960s in dynastic historiography and to some extent in local historiography. After the 1970s, Saudi nationalism becomes more important than Arab nationalism, also because Arab nationalism on the whole, in the whole Arab world, declines, partly as a result of Arab defeats against Israel. There was a war in 1967 against Israel that Arab countries lost in another war in 1973. Gamal Abdel Nasser died around 1970, and thereafter the Arab nationalist movement lost momentum and Saudi nationalism was on the rise.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask a question about Islamism, and I wonder how they dealt with the the sort of nascent forces, because it was in fashion in the 1940s and 50s, I think, and then it fell out of fashion during the socialist nationalist pan-Arab period, and then it came back, as mm-hmm. with us today. How did they deal with pan or Islamist ideology?
Well, if you will, the Wahhabi mission is actually connected to Islamist ideologies. The Wahhabi mission itself was and has been a religious reform movement. So the Saudi family, as a champion of the Wahhabi mission, of the mission of Sheikh Mohammed ibn Abdul Wahhab, has long seen itself as a leader of Islamic reform or a leader of Islam in the Muslim world, in the world in general. And especially these narratives about Jahiliya, about Saudi monarchs bringing the light of Islam to the darkness of an age of ignorance. These narratives serve to give Saudi monarchs a pan-Islamic legitimacy. Since the 1970s, these pan-Islamic narratives have not disappeared, but we've seen the rise of nationalist narratives such as unification and development of the country. I should say here that unification in the Saudi context is not entirely secular either, because the Arabic word that is used for unification is tawhid, which also means God's unity or monotheism. So the Saudis using a national narrative of unification is still sort of more religious than perhaps narratives of German unifications or of Italian unification.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they had the advantage of Wahhabism in the sense that they could say this was an element. It's a little bit like the Poles and Catholicism. You know, they could say, well, this is who we are. We're both Poles, but we're also Catholics. And it's sort of the same thing.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
Saudis often said, we are Saudis, we are Arabs, and we are Muslims. And some of them said, we are perhaps the best Arabs because we are the original Arabs from the heartland of the Arab world, from the Arabian Peninsula. And they also, perhaps saw themselves as the most formidable Muslims because they were the leaders of this Islamic reform movement started by Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab in the 18th century.
Yeah. This is a little bit of an aside. I'm curious, what do Saudis call themselves? Do they say do they say they're Saudi, or how do they speak of themselves? Do they say they're Arabs, or they're Muslims, or do they say how do they call themselves?
Yeah, in the at the high point of Arab nationalism around the 1950s, many Saudis would perhaps primarily identify as Arabs. Nevertheless, they've also always considered themselves Muslims too. And more recently, from the 1970s onwards, with the rise of Saudi nationalism, you have Saudis increasingly referring to themselves, perhaps primarily, as Saudis. Mm-hmm. This also has to do with again, globalization, Saudis traveling increasingly, meeting people from other nations abroad, also other Arabs, and then, of course, having to answer the question, where do you come from? Mm-hmm. And if a Saudi meets an Iraqi and the Iraqi asks the Saudi, where do you come from? The Saudi would say, from Saudi Arabia, rather than just I'm an Arab, because the Iraqi would probably have guessed that the person is an Arab, but is more interested in the specific question, which country?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the things that you talk about that assisted this nation building effort, nation building through historiography, is that I believe it was in the late 60s or early 70s, Saudi students began to go study history abroad. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Right. This is part of the development effort of the country. So development was not just the narrative to legitimize the country, but actually there was, of course, an actual development program with development plans, although not on socialist foundations like in the Soviet Union, but more on capitalist foundations because Saudi Arabia has been an ally of America. And in order to the to develop the country, it was seen as useful to send Saudi students abroad, and especially to allies such as America. Many Saudis in many, many disciplines studied abroad at major universities in Britain, in the United States of America, and other countries, including historians. And in one of my chapters on social and economic histories, I focus especially on a school of social and economic historians, many of whom studied at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, mm-hmm. Where they learned about social and economic history, especially during the 1980s, a time when economic history was the history du jour. And these historians then actually applied social and economic analysis to the history of the Saudi state and provided another yet different narrative and another at least subtle challenge to dynastic histories. Whereas dynastic history is often focused on the actions of the rulers and especially the religious factors and the political factors, the social and economic historians, many of whom were trained at UCL, try to explain the Saudi state in terms of a social or an economic creation. So some of the narratives that were produced was, for instance, that there was an economic crisis in Central Arabia, and that the Saudi state, perhaps rather than being a religious movement, was in fact a solution to social problems or economic problems at that time. Many of these histories then offer a materialist explanation of the creation of the Saudi state, which of course was a sensitive explanation because Saudi Arabia, as a religious country, as an Islamic country, and as a country allied with the free world, if you will, with America, saw itself as an opponent of atheism, of the Soviet Union, of the Eastern Bloc. And so these kinds of materialist explanations of the Saudi state were sensitive in the Saudi context.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I ask some questions about the sort of nuts and bolts of history in Saudi Arabia? And one question that occurs to me is, where do Saudi historians publish?
Very good question. And that, again, leads me to one of the central themes in my book, which is globalization. Increasingly, Saudis have published abroad as well as in the kingdom. In the beginning, some Saudis already published outside of the kingdom because printing presses appeared rather late in the Arabian Peninsula in sort of the last decades of the 19th century. And professional printing and typesetting expertise was more available outside of the outside of Saudi Arabia. So you had even dynastic histories being produced in other Arab countries. But of course, especially for authors of sensitive histories, whether it's local histories, regional histories, histories of the Shiites, or these social and economic histories, foreign places of publication provided protection to some extent from censorship. Whereas most domestic publications had to be vetted by the Ministry of Information, or Ministry of Culture and Information, as it was later called. Publications in Beirut, for instance, in Lebanon, did not need to go through censorship. And so with globalization, with increased access to publishers in Beirut, in London, and in other places, we see the proliferation of this plurality of different narratives. So the Saudi state has not been able to control the historiographical landscape entirely, because some elements of that landscape are publications written by Saudis but published abroad.
Mm-hmm. So if a historian wants to publish in Saudi Arabia, they have to submit a manuscript to the censor before it is published.
That's correct.
Yeah, but if they publish abroad, they don't have to.
Exactly. Right. If they publish in London or in Beirut.
Mm-hmm. Right. So books coming in over the border, do they have to be submitted to a censor?
To some extent, yes. However, curiously, many university libraries are actually exempt from censorship. So university libraries have actually been allowed to acquire banned books as long as they don't display them publicly. Mm-hmm. So there are actually loops. And since the 1990s, Saudi Arabia has been connected to the internet, and now Saudis have been able to publish books as ebooks or download books as ebooks, as PDF files from the internet with even less control by, let's say, the Ministry of Culture and Information.
Mm-hmm. Are there bookshops?
Yes, they are in most major cities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I have some questions about the way history is taught as well. At one point in the book, you mentioned that there's a very heavy Wahhabi influence on pedagogy in Saudi Arabia. How is history taught on what we would call the high school level in the United States, and then on the college level?
On the high school level, there is this very much this focus on dynastic history, so the history of the monarchs, including the religious and the sort of political narratives legitimizing their rule. On the college level, there is a more openness in the curriculum, and particularly Saudi history students, history majors, have been able to write undergraduate theses or master dissertations or doctoral dissertations on many other topics aside from dynastic histories, including social and economic histories, and including local and regional histories. And as in other countries, local and regional histories are sometimes seen as more suitable for the topic of a dissertation, because local history is seen as more of a manageable topic, and sometimes the student comes from the region that he or she wants to study, so they've got access to local sources, which gives the professor who's supervising a dissertation confidence in the completion of the dissertation. So we have actually seen many local and regional histories being first produced in the form of dissertations. Mm-hmm. And these dissertations sometimes employ this contribution narrative, where it is about the contribution of this region or that region to the establishment of the Saudi state, which challenges the notion of the Saudi state as being exclusively the creation of the Saudi monarchs. So interestingly, we see state-funded universities actually supporting the creation of narratives that sometimes contradict the dynastic official histories.
That's interesting. Let me go back to the high schools for a second. I don't know how to ask this question. When it comes to explaining how things happen in, say, a high school textbook, does it say, by the will of God, in 1932, the Saudi family came back to the throne? Or does it give some more materialist explanation for it?
Good question. It's certainly much more of a religious explanation that the Saudi family, as the leaders of the true religion, together with the scholars of the Wahhabi mission, have created the Saudi state with the blessing of God, most certainly. And materialist explanations have been considered sensitive because they have been sometimes seen as challenging the religious legitimacy of the Saudi state. And many sort of senior members of the government see the religious legitimacy of the Saudi state as the most important one. Interestingly, sometimes they have been strengthened in this view by the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
They saw that the Soviet Union collapsed, although it had a materialist ideology. So some Saudis, they looked at this and took the lesson from it that an Islamic legitimacy, a divine legitimacy, is the only long-term legitimacy that can help the Saudi state to survive and thrive.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know Saudi historians, and I just wondered, when you get them alone in the corner or in a room, what do they talk about? Do they think that they are, in some sense, hampered by state control? The reason I ask this, or my background in Russian history, I used to spend some time with Russian historians, Soviet historians at the time, and they would say, you know, well, there are certain topics we can study and certain topics we can't, and they didn't seem particularly upset about that. They just said that's the way things work.
Yeah. Good question. Certainly acknowledgments of red lines or sensitive topics. Mm-hmm. Tribal history, to some extent, is seen as a sensitive topic. The history of the Shiite religious minority is a sensitive topic. Materialist histories, to some extent, are sensitive. However, I think many Saudi historians would also acknowledge the huge amount of support that they actually got from the Saudi state as well. Uh-huh. So many Saudi historians who studied abroad at UCLA and other places did so with governmental scholarships, and they were later employed at Saudi state universities. The Saudi state, being an oil state, sometimes called a rentier state, provides numerous benefits to all its citizens, including historians. And the Saudi state, through its governmental agencies, has supported the publication of many different histories, not just narrowly dynastic histories, but sometimes even histories that could be seen as more sensitive. So I think what I would like to do in this book, and what also many Saudi historians acknowledge, is that this Saudi state's role is perhaps double-edged, that there is censorship, but there's also a lot of support. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, there is control, but there's also a lot of funding for historians, for historical studies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's funny because there's a similar sort of situation in at least the sort of the people that I knew during the Soviet Union who studied history. They were all supported by the state and were very grateful for it. And many of them didn't have to teach, for example, and they had access to all the archives they wanted. They were actually quite well taken care of, and they recognized that. So the censorship didn't really bother them so much. They realized that, you know, that it was actually a pretty good gig.
And I, for instance, I don't know of a single university-based Saudi historian who went to prison for political reasons. So I think overall, Saudi historians are actually quite comfortable. They have limitations, but they also have more opportunities than perhaps historians do in poorer countries.
Yeah, who drive cabs.
For instance.
Yeah. That's good. Well, why don't we leave it at that? Today we've been talking with Matthias Dietermann about his book, Historiography in Saudi Arabia, Globalization and the State in the Middle East. Matthias, why don't we close the interview with our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Thanks for that question. Now, I'm staying in the history of the Arab world, and I'm also staying in the history of scholarship. However, I'm moving to a different area of scholarship, that is science. I am right now working on two books. One is a history of biology in the Gulf states, and the second book is a history of modern astronomy in the wider Arab world. So I'm trying to expand my circles, whereas with this first book of mine, I focused only on Saudi Arabia. With the second book, I'm trying to cover the Gulf states as a whole. And with that third book on astronomy in the Arab world, I'm trying to study the entire Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
These are also under-researched topics. We know a lot about history of science in the pre-modern Arab world, in the medieval Islamic world, but we know rather little about the natural sciences in the modern and contemporary Arab world.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with those projects, and I hope that you'll come back on the show when you're done with them.
Oh, with great pleasure.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Let me say again that we've been talking to Matthias Dietermann about his book, Historiography in Saudi Arabia, Globalization and the State in the Middle East. Let me first say, Matthias, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And let me say to all the people who listen to the many interviews on the New Books Network, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you have a great week.